This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoen. The 2012 election broke records for campaign contributions and spending. Looks like a whopping $7 billion was spent just 2 years ago. With the midterm election coming up in November, planning for 2016 is already in the works. We're going to be talking about the role that money is playing and has played in shaping politics. And our guest, Kenneth Vogel, has been tracking money in politics for Politico. Citizens United unleashed lots of money into the political system, gave individuals and PACs more clout than political parties, while 8 million small donors gave about $500 million to Obama, Romney, and their supporters in 2012. Just 46 well-heeled donors gave that same amount to those campaigns. That's what our guest Ken Vogel writes about in his new book. It's called Big Money. It's about how a small number of people have opened their wallets to political candidates and what they and we have gotten in return. As I said, Ken Vogel tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. He joins us from the studios of Politico. And Ken Vogel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Marty.
That was a little shaky start there, but we're happy to have you with us. There's always been money in politics. What's different today, and does it all go back to Citizens United?
No, actually, it started before Citizens United, really with the 2002 McCain-Feingold decision. This was supposed to be the decision, rather the law that would take money out of politics, but instead what it started to do was to push money outside of the official party system and the candidates who really had sort of controlled politics for years and years to these outside groups that were increasingly powerful and increasingly able to accept huge sums of money from very wealthy folks to kind of do what they wanted outside of the system, and it sort of stripped the party of some of the control, the parties of some of the control that they had had over the years, and empowered these very wealthy folks. Well, the first year that we had this in a presidential campaign was 2004. There was some scrutiny applied to some of these groups and some of the billionaires who funded them after the election, because there were still some laws in place that restricted the flow of this unlimited money to these outside groups. Well, the Citizens United decision in 2010 really stripped away those rules and those laws and made it a wild, wild west type of environment. And that's what we saw in 2012.
And the idea that these PACs or super PACs are not supposed to coordinate with candidates, I mean, can people really say that with a straight face anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it's really a very thin line, and the laws are really insufficient to prevent the types of de facto coordination that a lot of the campaign finance reformers worry about and think that really creates the opportunity for some of these very wealthy backers and some of these outside groups to exert a huge influence, not just over the politics and over the election, but to really create at least the patina of corruption and of these candidates owing these very wealthy donors, which of course is what these campaign finance rules are intended to prevent.
Well, let me go back to 2012 and Sheldon Adelson. First, he supported Newt Gingrich, then he supported Mitt Romney. I forget exactly how much money he invested in those losing campaigns, but here's a very, very wealthy man who lost a lot of money backing, obviously, the wrong candidates. What's in it for someone like Sheldon Adelson?
Well, Sheldon Adelson, I mean, if you think about it, he's worth $40 billion. And so he invested $100 million in this campaign. A lot of people sort of ask the question, why would he spend so much? What you said, what's in it for him? Why would he spend that much money? I think the real question is, why did he only spend that much money? I mean, $100 million for a guy who's worth $40 billion is the equivalent of you or I going out and, you know, buying a $50 dinner. It's really nothing for him. And the way that I think about it and what these guys want, what their motivation is, and they are mostly guys at this point, mostly older white guys at that, is that they think of this as sort of like their hobby almost. I mean, there are some who do have a little bit of financial self-interest, and they may in fact have a situation where their giving does align with that financial self-interest, but I don't necessarily think that that is the animating cause behind their political giving, that it is more driven by ideology. These are folks who have made all the money in the world. They have all the vacation homes, the yachts, the corporate jets that they might want, and they are political junkies. So for them, what's next? It's almost like their new toy, and if they have an ideology or a loyalty to a given candidate, this is a way to express that that allows them to participate in a really unprecedented way in our history in what is their passion, politics.
But I'm assuming that they care about a particular candidate's stand on certain issues. I mean, there's a reason Adelson supported Newt Gingrich, I'm assuming. Or maybe he liked just to talk history, I don't know, with Newt Gingrich.
Well, yeah, he was his animating issue for Sheldon Adelson is Israel and the defense of Israel. Now, this is not an issue that really has a whole lot of bearing on his bottom line. He's made all of his money through casinos. In many ways, he's made his money by betting, pun intended, against conventional wisdom going into Las Vegas when it was considered sort of a seedy gambling town, and creating a convention business and a family travel business out there, going into the Macau region of China when it was considered sort of a low-end gambling market, and making it into sort of a Las Vegas of the East. And so he cared about Israel and the defense of Israel. He had a loyalty to Newt Gingrich going back years and years, and people were telling him, hey, Newt Gingrich, there's no way that he can win the presidency. You're wasting your money. But when someone like Sheldon Adelson, who has made his money bucking conventional wisdom, hears people trying to talk him down, he's not really inclined to listen. Mm-hmm. And I talked to one of his close advisors, Ari Fleischer, the former White House press secretary under George W. Bush, who was among the folks who was trying to talk Sheldon Adelson down from giving all this money to Newt Gingrich. And he said, you know, Ken, billionaires, sometimes they're not the best listeners. And Sheldon Adelson would be a case in point there. Now, it's interesting because ultimately his real goal was defeating President Barack Obama, and all this spending, particularly the $20 million that he and his family gave to the super PAC supporting Newt Gingrich, may have actually worked against that, may have actually extended the primary in a way that damaged the eventual nominee, Mitt Romney, and sent him kind of limping into the general election versus Barack Obama, and undercut Sheldon Adelson's real goal of defeating Obama.
This is a more present example, and it doesn't involve billionaires, but I'm thinking about Eric Cantor's loss to David Bratt in Virginia. Bratt was outspent, I don't know, 5-10, maybe more to 1, and he beat Eric Cantor, which raises the question about just the role that money either does or doesn't play in politics.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, and that's a great example of an instance where the money may have backfired, and it's not dissimilar in some ways from the example that we just talked about with Sheldon Adelson and Newt Gingrich. Eric Cantor had this huge financial advantage. Now, we should point out that Eric Cantor's advantage and most of Eric Cantor's money was hard money. This is the kind of money that is limited by the existing federal campaign finance laws and is not this big money that Sheldon Adelson invested, but rather cap donations from political action committees and other sort of insiders that incumbent members of Congress have an advantage in raising money from, let alone someone like Eric Cantor, who was the majority leader and had a very distinct advantage and was known as a prolific fundraiser. However, he had all this money, and he spent it attacking this guy much earlier than many people thought was necessary. And on election night, Dave Bratt actually thanked Eric Cantor and said, you know, if it weren't for Eric Cantor's ads attacking me as a liberal college professor, which on its face was sort of patently ridiculous, many folks wouldn't have even known that there was a primary race going on. And so this is sort of a misspending of money, and we see a lot of it. The more money flows into the system, the more folks are trying to, consultants and others are trying to take advantage of it and take advantage, frankly, of some of these big donors. And a lot of this money gets wasted embraced it and has sort of a backlash type effect, which I think you could argue was the case both with Sheldon Adelson's support of Newt Gingrich and with Eric Cantor's huge campaign spending in his race against Dave Brat.
And by wasted, you mean wasted on ads?
Yeah, wasted on ads and wasted on sort of ham-handed political strategy. You know, I compare these big donors, who in many cases are driving the political strategy of these new groups, to sports team owners. Again, they're folks who have made all this money and sort of have all the luxuries and slapped their names on all the wings of hospitals and their academic alma maters that they can. And so what is next for them? Well, if you're a sports junkie who has made all this money, maybe you go and buy a sports team. And again, we see it with here in Washington, the Redskins are there in Philadelphia, going back to the Norman Brayman Philadelphia Eagles, where someone who has made all this money in their chosen field, Norman Brayman was a car dealer, he thought he had a sense, he had this aptitude for sort of figuring things out and that it should be applicable to running the Philadelphia Eagles. Mm. Well, under Norman Brayman, that they made a series of ham-handed decisions in the draft, personnel, and even play calling, coaching decisions, and it traces back to the sugar daddy, Norman Brayman. Well, in this case, we have these mega donors who are spending all this money in politics, and they think because they follow it that their expertise should be applicable. And so they're telling the consultants, hey, you need to air ads on this issue that they really care about, when maybe political strategy, a sort of more textbook analysis of it, would suggest that that's not the right strategy.
But these are very wealthy business people. I'm assuming they want to win. Yes, maybe they like to gamble and they like to throw their money around. But bottom line, it seems to me, they want to win, don't they?
Yeah, they certainly want to win. But I don't think for someone like Sheldon Adelson, it's not necessarily the end result that is as important as,
really,
as sort of shaping the debate and shaping the debate over Israel. And, you know, ultimately, there's not really a whole lot of difference, Sheldon Adelson and maybe his allies would argue otherwise, but between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney on Sheldon Adelson's driving issue, that is the defense of Israel. So he sort of shaped the debate and shaped the contours of what is the acceptable political debate on options to consider for the U.S. Stances on the defense of Israel.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation again. Ken Vogel is our guest. We are talking about money and politics, something he does as a reporter, tracking the confluence of money, politics, and influence for Politico. He's got a new book called Big Money. It's subtitled $2.5 Billion, One Suspicious Vehicle, and a Pimp on the Trail of the Ultra-Rich Hijacking American Politics. You've got a sense, a flavor of what Ken Vogel thinks about money in politics and the role that it played in 2012. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Broadway Philadelphia, presenting The Book of Mormon, winner of 9 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. From the creators of South Park, The Book of Mormon comes to the Forest Theater beginning July 29th. Broadway Philadelphia, presenting The Book of Mormon at the Forest Theater beginning July 29th. Information and tickets available online at telecharge.com or at the Forest Theater box office. Broadway Philadelphia, presenting The Book of Mormon, supports WHYY.
You are living in an episode of Star Trek every day of your life.
Kirk here.
Scotty here, Captain.
Think about it. The communicator could only talk to other members of the Enterprise crew. They should have been able to talk to anybody in the universe.
Inventing the cell phone and other feats of science fiction. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. How exactly do you close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba? A human rights activist says it's perfectly doable.
The administration has always had the ability to close Guantanamo. What it's lacked is the political will to do so.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Ken Vogel about money and politics and his new book called Big Money, looking back at the 2012 presidential election, the money that was spent, the money that was lost as well. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Ken, you got into a meeting. It was held by the Koch brothers. This was in 2013, and it sounds like you were hanging out by a bar overhearing some conversations of some frustrated Republicans who were frustrated with the party, frustrated with Rince Priebus about the party and its call for money. What role do parties play? Are they just sort of playing around the edges when it comes to politics under these money circumstances?
Yeah, the parties are really finding themselves kind of strapped for money, because these big donors, the folks who had funded the parties in the past, are able to give more money to these outside groups and are able to exert more influence over what these outside groups do. And as a result, the parties are sort of strapped for, are seeing their control over the system diminish as well. And where we really see this is in the primaries, because the parties, no matter how much money they raise, even if they weren't sort of struggling to keep up with the fundraising of these outside groups, they still wouldn't go into these primaries. They want to have the primaries sort of play out on their own right, where these outside groups, particularly those that are funded by just a single donor or a handful of donors, they feel no such qualms about wading into the primaries. And to go back to the 2012 Republican presidential primary with Sheldon Adelson, there's no way that a party is going to go and put their thumb on the scale of a primary like that in favor of a single candidate like Sheldon Adelson did with Newt Gingrich. Well, these big donors feel like this is their right if they're spending all that money. And if the parties aren't going to do it and aren't going to spend the money as the donors see fit, then they can literally start their own outside group, start their own super PAC, and wade in a way that the parties would never do. And so as a result, we've seen the party's role really diminish. And there's a real debate going on in Washington, D.C., among both parties about sort of what to do to reverse this tide. And so far, I don't really see a whole lot of viable options for the party sort of reasserting their role as dominant forces in American politics.
And I want to pick up on that. Does it also explain this? I seem sort of obsessed with the 2012 primary, but does that also explain the fact that it kept going on and on and on, is that you had these big donors that kept spending money and sort of, in a sense, kept the candidates continuing to run?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And if they, you know, weren't without these big donors, and literally, you know, just a single big donor in the case of Sheldon Adelson and Newt Gingrich, or Foster Freeze, who was this multimillionaire mutual fund pioneer who backed Rick Santorum, former Pennsylvania senator, of course, his campaign. You know, there were folks who were telling them, hey, you should stand down. You should let Mitt Romney win the nomination and let him, you know, go into the general election against Barack Obama. And the parties were sort of powerless to stop this. And so it extended for, you know, months and months after it would have otherwise ended had these candidates not had these sugar daddies sort of keeping them afloat in a way that, again, was sort of detrimental or at least harmful to the party's overall goal of winning the White House.
How do people like Karl Rove and the Koch brothers, who you write about, how do they view each other?
Well, actually, Karl Rove, I mean, this is really where we see the impact of this big money. Again, it's in the primaries. It's it's not the general election so much, where I think that we sort of see some of the same contours of the debate going on. And, you know, Barack Obama, even if he were outspent by much more than he was outspent on the outside front with this big money, you know, it's arguable probably he still would have won. But where we see it play out is in these primaries, and we see sort of a fight for the soul of the parties. And so far, we've seen this more on the right, where you have sort of the centrist wing of the party represented by Karl Rove and some of his big donors, who are trying to steer the Republican Party to a sort of more centrist course that would be more compromising on fiscal issues in particular, and having really a big fight on their hands with these major donors who see sort of a more fiscal purist approach as being the right one for the Republican Party. And they are represented sort of most acutely by the Koch brothers and the groups that they fund, which are going to spend, we've heard, as much as $290 million in these midterm elections trying to support candidates who are not going to compromise on these fiscal issues. And we don't have to look a whole lot further than the federal government shutdown last year to see the results of this in our governing. John Boehner was unable to get the votes necessary to pass a compromise deal to raise the debt ceiling and fund the federal government and keep it open, because he and the party really didn't have a whole lot to offer these Tea Party members of his conference, and who really looked more towards the Koch brothers and towards these outside groups that helped them get elected in 2010 and whose support they would need to get reelected in 2014. John Boehner can't compete with that. The only person and the only sort of pole or center of gravity that could is Karl Rove. And Karl Rove was kind of diminished by 2012. He made some big promises about what he would be able to do if he were able to raise a certain amount of money. He spent $325 million through his outside groups, his super PAC, the American Crossroads super PAC, and didn't really have a whole lot to show for it. Well, some of the donors sort of soured on him, and so the Koch brothers emerged as the preeminent pole in the sort of Republican shadow party universe, and they are in the driver's seat, and they and their groups would probably support candidates who would sort of lurch us into another government shutdown if they were sort of looking at it just from a policy perspective.
What's interesting, though, about the Koch brothers is, as you write and others have as well, I guess David and Charles have libertarian perspectives on things like same-sex marriage, on drug legalization, obviously wanting small government. I mean, that's one of their obvious big roles. But do you see them and the Tea Party as sort of odd fellows that, you know, when you analyze their positions, may really not see eye to eye in some essential issues?
Yeah, certainly. And I think what they, you know, for years and years were trying to steer not just the Republican Party, but really the entire American body politic to a more libertarian perspective that was more laissez-faire on social issues and more non-interventionist on military and international foreign policy. And they didn't really have a whole lot of luck, despite having spent tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars prior to, say, 2005, 2006. And so at that point, they did, in fact, start to align more with the Republican Party, thinking that this was the way for them to have the greatest possible impact, and for their spending to have the greatest possible impact on American politics. Well, come 2008 and the election of Barack Obama and the Tea Party backlash to it, I think they saw an opportunity there with the Tea Party activists sort of providing the ground troops for a real libertarian movement within the Republican Party or even outside the Republican Party. And so they seized on that and attempted to harness it with the political groups that they had already seeded. The Americans for Prosperity is the big one that really got out front of the Tea Party and kind of put the Koch brothers stamp on it, even though in many ways the Tea Party did have elements of it that were sort of more traditionally Republican and maybe anathema to the Koch brothers' own perspective, such as a social conservative view that would oppose same-sex marriage or abortion rights, both of which David Koch at least supports, and maybe be a little bit more hawkish in its foreign policy, which David Koch at least opposes. So, yes, there's definitely an odd bedfellows element there, but again, it sort of shows the pragmatic nature of the Kochs and their political spending. They want to have an impact, and the Tea Party was sort of the vehicle for them to attempt to do that. Now, of course, the Tea Party is on the wane, and it'll be interesting to see whether these Koch brother-backed groups continue to affiliate with it.
You said the Tea Party is on the wane?
Yeah, I think it is. It's on the wane in the sense that, you know, other than Dave Brat, who we talked about earlier, we haven't seen a whole lot of Tea Party candidates who have been able to defeat establishment Republican candidates in 2014 midterm primaries. Obviously, the party will again sort of have a chance to debate its direction in the 2016 presidential primaries. And that's actually, I think, where it's going to be interesting to watch the Democratic side. We've been talking a lot about the Republicans, but I think Democrats have avoided some of the sort of pitfalls of this new big money environment because they've had some ideological unity, largely as a result of having the White House, having control of the United States Senate. But in 2016, there will be a big debate about the direction of the Democratic Party, and we already see it starting. And despite the efforts of the sort of biggest donors and the most savvy operatives to sort of coalesce behind Hillary Clinton, all it would take in this new environment is a single billionaire, Democratic billionaire, to go ahead and get behind a more progressive alternative to Hillary Clinton, say an Elizabeth Warren or Howard Dean or a Russ Feingold, and write an eight-figure or a nine-figure check supporting that person, and it would throw the entire effort to sort of coronate Hillary Clinton into chaos in much the same way that we saw with the Republican effort to align behind Mitt Romney in 2012.
Well, that would be a very interesting development. Let me reintroduce you. That's Ken Vogel, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, author of a new book called Big Money, and he tracks big money and politics and influence for Politico. Joins us from their studios. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. How do you see the role, the influence of money and politics? Let me pick up on something that actually you quote in your book, and this is Obama talking to some big donors, and he says to them, I mean, there are five or six people in this room tonight that could simply make a decision. This will be the next president and probably at least get a nomination if ultimately this person didn't win, but that's not the way things are supposed to work. Essentially picking up on what you just said, which is a very rich person could help a nominee sort of rise, if not win an election, certainly rise to the top.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a really stark assessment to hear from Barack Obama, who, of course, since his earliest days in politics, cast himself as a champion of political reform and of reducing the role of big money in politics. I mean, this was one of his driving issues back in the 1990s when he was sort of first getting involved in politics in Chicago. His biggest accomplishment in the Illinois State Senate was a package of lobbying reforms that limited or at least heightened the disclosure for lobbyists raising money for candidates, and ditto in the United States Senate when he was elected back in 2004. His biggest accomplishment was a provision in the post-Jack Abramoff series of lobbying reforms that required increased disclosure for lobbyists who were bundling contributions from their associates. And in 2008, he did, in fact, manage to sort of manifest this reformist platform in his own fundraising, where he raised a record-shattering $750 million, which now seems kind of quaint, but he raised it from small donors and utilizing the internet and utilizing some of the social media. He was able to tap into what his people called a small donor revolution, and they predicted that this would be the future of politics and of political fundraising. Well, of course, what happened between 2008 and 2012, his reelection campaign, was this Citizens United decision. And Barack Obama, despite the way that he cast himself as a reformer, ended up having to, by necessity, embrace this new big money environment. And he ended up blessing a super PAC to go ahead and raise big money from Democratic wealthy donors in order to support his campaign. Whether he could have won without it, I think is debatable, but certainly it did play a big role in branding Mitt Romney as sort of an out-of-touch elitist who was only catering to the needs of the very wealthy, ironically. But he was deemed by many people who saw him in him a champion for changing the way that money influenced politics as a great disappointment as a result of his embracing this new environment, which, you know, I think is the new normal. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be very, very difficult, something that he admitted in this speech that we were able to quote to these very wealthy donors, that this is sort of the new politics, and anyone who tries to buck it is going to find it very, very difficult to get the type of trajectory that is necessary to run a real presidential campaign.
Do you think that's a problem for Democrats, that you complain, and President Obama called out the Supreme Court when he gave one of his State of the Union addresses about Citizens United to sort of criticize a decision and then use it to your own advantage? It seems someone like a Sheldon Adelson is not embarrassed about throwing money around, and I wonder whether this is a particular problem for Democrats who rail against the wealthy and then have their wealthy donors that help to fund their campaigns.
Yeah, Democrats do have sort of a schizophrenia on this issue, and the hypocrisy charge, I think, is a pretty poignant one, and one that can be made and is being made by Republicans as Democrats head into the 2014 midterms, trying to make a real issue out of big Republican money in politics generally, and the Koch brothers specifically. You can't go a day when the Senate is in session anymore, it seems, without hearing Harry Reid take to the Senate floor to bash the Koch brothers. Well, in fact, Harry Reid's allies are running not one, but two of these outside groups, both a super PAC and a non-disclosing 501c4 social welfare nonprofit that are raising unlimited money to help Democrats and to help Harry Reid's own allies try to keep control of the Senate. So while it's certainly understandable that they would participate in this new big money reality, because it's just the way things are now, it does create a problem when they try to, at least an optical problem, when they try to make an issue of the other side's money in politics.
About a minute before our break here, isn't it weird that we can throw around 501c4s and people sort of know what we're talking about?
Yeah, this is the new normal, and these are the tools of the new normal. 501c4 social welfare nonprofit is a nonprofit corporation that is set up under this section of the tax code that was supposed to be for social welfare nonprofits, things like community recreation leagues and the like, but is now being used by these very savvy political operatives and very well compensated lawyers who are looking for new vehicles to get money into politics to accept huge checks. And the difference between a super PAC and a 501c4 nonprofit is that the 501c4 nonprofits do not have to disclose the names of their donors. So folks who might be a little bit leery about entering the fray in a way that might expose them to targeting of the sort that Harry Reid has done to the Koch brothers could avail themselves of this option to give huge sums without the risk of their name being disclosed through a 501c4 nonprofit.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our guest, Ken Vogel, talking about money, politics, and influence. His new book is called Big Money, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I want to get to some of our callers after the break, and also folks who are sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University has been offering graduate studies for over 50 years. Today, Westchester has over 70 graduate degree and certificate programs in business and public affairs, health, visual and performing arts, education, arts and sciences, and their new doctorate of nursing practice. With campuses in suburban Chester County, the new Center City, Philadelphia location, or online. Details at wcupa.edu/grad. graduate education at Westchester University. Learn more.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about cybercrime and cybersecurity with Brian Krebs, former Washington Post reporter who writes the blog Krebs on Security. He exposes cybercrime networks and as a result has also been a target of cybercriminals. He broke the stories about the credit card breaches at Target and Neiman Marcus. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The language wars.
I saw my friends being injured and I saw their dead body. I don't want to see anymore my friends going to die.
The fate of Afghan interpreters who worked alongside American soldiers, well paid for their services, now seen as traitors in their home country. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Ken Vogel about politics and money, something that he covers for Politico. Let me just read a couple of email comments that we have. One emailer asking to compare the leverage of Warren Buffett for the Democrats against the Republican big donors. I would throw in someone like maybe a George Soros, or there's a, you write about a Stephen Amber Mostyn. Do the Democratic, I guess the liberal Democrats, do they have the same kind of clout, you think, that some of the Republicans like the Koch brothers have?
Short answer, no. They really have not come and joined the fray of this new sort of big money politics in the same way thus far. And some of it, I think, actually goes back to 2004. You mentioned George Soros. He was sort of the prototype of the new mega donor. He, after this McCain-Feingold law passed and sort of forced some of the money from the party and candidate committees to these outside groups, he was among the real early adapters of this. He and a guy by the name of Peter Lewis, who recently died, mm-hmm. who was the founder of Progressive Insurance, they gave the lion's share of around $200 million to these outside groups on the left that tried to defeat George W. Bush in 2004. Obviously, they were unsuccessful. The combination of that lack of success with the scrutiny that they then received after 2004 from the Federal Election Commission, which suggested that this type of giving may have violated laws that at that time were still in place, now have been struck down, sort of forced them to the sideline, and they became discouraged with this big money political world, and they have really not come back. At least the biggest of the liberal donors have not really come back in the same way that conservatives like the Koch brothers have. What's interesting is that some of these donors now are sort of being coaxed back into the game, but it's unclear whether they'll be able to compete with the conservatives, because some of the wealthiest Democrats, some of the wealthiest liberals, I mean, the emailer cites Warren Buffett. Well, Warren Buffett doesn't really give big political contributions. He is politically active, in some ways suggesting policies that he thinks would lead to a more equitable distribution of wealth, taxation policies and the like. But he doesn't give anywhere near the sort of percentage of his net worth into politics as the Koch brothers do. And if he or someone like Bill Gates, who was actually in that room where Obama gave that speech that I quote in my book that you read from, where he said there are five or six people in this room tonight who could influence the next presidential election. Obama there goes on to say, in fact, Bill, you could write a check and just swamp anything that anyone else would do. And that's true, but Bill Gates has not done that. And he has not come into the fray in the same way that the Koch brothers have. And if he were to give the same percentage of his income or of his net worth into politics as the Koch brothers or someone like the late Bob Perry, a Texas home builder, did, it could really change the whole game. It could change the landscape, he or Warren Buffett, but the fact is they don't. And whether it's because they are sort of appalled by this idea that their money could have such a big impact in politics, or or because they would rather spend their sort of charitable giving on other things like Bill Gates's campaign to cure malaria. For whatever reason, they haven't come in, and it's really much to Democrat chagrin. There are Democratic operatives who are constantly trying to get Bill Gates to write that big check, but he hasn't.
We have another emailer. This is Eric, and he says that billionaires support Republican Party mainly with the aim of eliminating the capital gains tax. Do you think he's right, Ken?
There's certainly some of that, and we do see a major effort by some of these wealthy conservatives, particularly the sort of business wing of the Republican Party, to affect taxation policies in a way that probably would impact their bottom line very favorably. But my premise in all this is that the big money political spending is really more for passion or for ego or for ideology or for loyalty, as opposed to pad the pockets of the donors themselves. There are other ways that these major donors and wealthy corporations and special interests are able to more effectively navigate the political process to affect changes that are sort of beneficial to their bottom lines. And those include lobbying or capped hard money donations, smaller donations, that is, through political action committees to the relevant committee chairman or ranking members or political party committees that have jurisdiction over their business interests. And I think that is both cheaper and more effective in terms of benefiting their bottom line by enacting tax policies that redound to their benefit or whatever else that they're seeking. This big money spending is maybe less geared towards achieving that end.
Let me get Keith to join our conversation. Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty and Ken.
Hi there.
I have a bottom line question that's sort of a true-false. I know this kind of big money goes to organizational work. It goes towards lobbying efforts, et cetera. But here's true-false for you. Does the really big money that's being accumulated, especially on the conservative side, essentially go to television commercials, to social media, to paper products, to convince the narrow-minded, the ill-informed, the one-issue people, the folks who only watch Fox News, who are pretty narrow in their illumination politically, to say, hey, you're right, you should be afraid of this, you should support people just like you and nobody else, come out and vote just on this one issue or this one guy? Is that where most of the money goes, just to convince the people that they want to get out? Because the vote is the political power, not the influence, it's essentially the vote. Is that where most of the really big money goes? TV ads for the narrow-minded?
Well, there are narrow-minded people that watch other stations as well. I'll just toss that out there, Ken. But let me give Ken Vogel a chance to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the caller has a great point, which is that there is a very narrow swath of the electorate that ends up deciding these elections. And so the truly persuadable folks, whether they can be reached by a big money television ad campaign or a social media campaign or a direct mail campaign that sends these glossy mailers out to their house, I mean, it's very difficult to reach those people. And so a lot of money gets spent and arguably wasted trying to just motivate the base. So you are trying to get these folks who already agree with you to come out and to make sure that they come out to vote. And you do that by trying to strike a chord with them on issues where you know that they already agree with you. And so there is a ton of money that's spent just trying to get these voters mobilized, mobilized in a way that is not really affecting the overall electorate in the sense that it is not convincing the people who are not already convinced of the superiority of your ideas or your candidate, but rather is just sort of preaching to the choir. And it's an expensive proposition. Well, either way, it's an expensive proposition when you're trying to reach those very narrow swath of swing voters who may be persuadable, and it's also expensive to try to get out the vote of folks who are already persuaded. And so there is an argument that is made that a lot of this money, it sort of reaches a point of diminishing returns, and maybe there is a better way to spend it, but there is a real industry now. This is this cottage
Indeed.
Industry of television ad campaigns, direct mail. It's politics, and we do it. It's a $7 billion industry, and so a lot of money gets churned through it in ways that, you know, maybe are not as effective as they could be.
I also think that there are people that make ads knowing it'll show up on TV, on and in TV shows, news shows, so that they analyze it and show it, and you get some freebies out of it.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're all sort of part of this industry. We in,
yes,
in political journalism who cover this stuff, and the ad makers and the pundits, and you know, the commercial broadcast industry obviously makes a whole lot of money during elections as well, airing these ads. Airtime is not cheap, and even as it migrates more and more to the internet, there are still TV stations that depend on ad revenue from these outside groups, and Citizens United has been a boon to them.
Let me get Billy to join our conversation. Hi, Billy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning, Marty. Well, you guys just touched on what I was thinking about, and I sometimes wonder whether Citizens United is not just the last gasp of big money, because as your guest just pointed out, a large portion of the cost of getting elected is buying media. And we now know in the age we live in that the internet has crushed every business model. And that's what you're really talking about, the business model to get elected. The internet has crushed the business models of newspapers and the music industry by making it cheaper to get their product or their message to their customers. I just think it's a matter of time before someone gets elected to very high office in this country, perhaps even the presidency, who runs a YouTube campaign and runs the entire process that you guys have been talking about. I really do think that Citizens United is like a this last cry of very wealthy and powerful people saying, please let my money matter for something.
Well, Billy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I wonder, Ken, if that was something that President Obama did in 2008. He didn't do it in 2012 after Citizens United. But do you see Citizens United as a kind of last gasp of the wealthy and well-connected?
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. I mean, the caller makes a very valid point, though, about a lot of this type of targeting and communication across all spheres, not just politics, migrating to the web. However, that's an industry as well. And this big money is, in fact, flowing to digital media campaigns and digital media targeting in a way that I think we're just sort of scraping the surface of. President Obama, you're right, in 2008, he was able to use social media effectively to mobilize voters. In 2012, though, there was a whole lot of targeting that was going on that we sort of found out after the fact about him doing these Facebook scrapes, where he wasn't just, you know, when you liked Barack Obama's campaign on Facebook, you were accepting that they could use the cookies from your Facebook account to gather data about you, and they weren't just gathering data about you and who your friends were. They were going deeper than that, and they were looking at, and it was an automated process, but they were able to assess, like, who you were closest to by virtue of who you tagged in your photos that you posted on Facebook, and then they would target you by – they would target those people if they were deemed to be persuadable by trying to go through you to get to them. And so all that stuff is expensive as well, and we do see this type of unlimited outside money being spent on that stuff as well, and I think that we'll see more and more of it. But – I think these donors still like to see their money being used for these big, flashy TV ads, and so there is a little bit of a lag in terms of how other spheres of advertising and other industries are migrating online versus how politics is a little bit slower of a process.
But if the Supreme Court says that money essentially is speech, and that's the Buckley-Valeo ruling of a number of years ago, and that corporations are people, if we're talking about money in politics, do you see that as corruption, or do you see that as just the way the system works, Kim?
I see it as the way the system works. I mean, what the Supreme Court was very clear on, two things that I think, you know, reformers do have some valid concerns about. One, they said, that this unlimited money was okay and it wouldn't be corrupting as long as it was spent independent from these candidates. And as you sort of alluded to earlier, Marty, the line between some of these outside groups and the candidates and the causes that they support is thin and blurry. And in some cases, there doesn't appear to be that separation that the Supreme Court said was necessary to avoid corruption. The other area in which I think there are legitimate concerns about Citizens United was in the majority decision and in subsequent Supreme Court cases that have got at this area of money and politics, they said that disclosure is key. And as long as the voters are able to determine from where the money is coming for the political speech, whether it's in a TV ad or an online campaign or what have you, then the possibility of corruption is diminished and is sort of kept in check because voters are able to sort of calculate what the bottom line interest of the folks who are funding the campaign is. Well, that is becoming harder and harder to do with these 501c4 nonprofits, which were empowered by Citizens United to do more with unlimited money without disclosing the names of donors. And so I do think that that is an area that is still sort of evolving, where we could see it go either way. We could see even more of the money become difficult to trace and impossible to sort of follow the money, which is what I try to do in this book. Or we could see legislation that would heighten these disclosure requirements and make it easier for voters and the media to find out where the money is coming from and how it's being spent.
And Ken, about a minute before we have to say goodbye, a caller we can't take, but he had a question I had. We've been focusing largely on millionaires and billionaires, but Citizens United was also about unions. How much influence do you think they have in the political process?
I think they still have a great deal, but I think it's diminishing because their ranks are diminishing. And frankly, there have also been court decisions that have made it harder for them to organize and to utilize their union dues for political activity. I do see in some cases there's a secretive club of Democratic donors called the Democracy Alliance, and unions have become more influential in that in recent years. And so they are clearly recognizing that this is a sort of changing area, and in order for them to continue to have the level of influence that they've had in Democratic politics over the years, which has been great, they too need to adapt to this new big money atmosphere, and they're having trouble doing it thus far.
Well, on that note, Ken Vogel, thanks very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
He tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence for political, and he's author of a new book called Big Money. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out about podcasts of the show, Twitter, Facebook, sign up for our newsletter, and how to find us on satellite radio. Emily Hawes answering the phones for today's edition of Radio Times. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.